know, I left behind the memories, I left behind the dreams, frozen in my thought like stitches in the seams.
So, appreciate you coming on. Yeah, making the drive out.
Yeah, no, I'm really pleased to be here. And as I said, I enjoyed checking out your background and some of the similarities we have.
Yeah. You were saying, okay, just, what was it? Just picture interviewing yourself in 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, just with all these different interests. What is your, you know, North Star or guiding light in, you know, following your passions and your interests? Because, you know, self-described eclectic life right. You've lived.
I guess a couple of things shaped it. One is I've always had interest in art and poetry and things like that, which was one side of me. And then there was also a very competitive side to me. Mm. But I had a racing crash on a motorcycle when I was 22. Ended up with 11 hours of neurosurgery, a plate in my head, pin through 5 breaks in my right leg and a compound fracture in my left leg. It was a mess. It was in the coma for a few days. And, you know, you come out of it and you're saying, wow, man, that's interesting. Here I am. And I thought to myself, you know, if I died then, I wouldn't have regretted a minute of my life. I was so engaged in it. I thought, I got to try and live the rest of my life like that. And so I guess if there's a North Star, it's just that engagement.
Right.
Right.
Right. I think that, yeah, that is where the action is when you lose yourself, you know, in the activity that you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
And it isn't about the result either. I mean, one of the things, there's a quote I always like by Emerson. It goes, the people who stop at life's first success are the world's spiritual middle classes. They're stopping at success is proof positive.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, to me, you know, if you were to write an interesting book, maybe that needs to be written, maybe you call it second place. It's not the winners that have the only stories, you know. In fact,
right.
Most of the stories are somewhere else. And you know, so I feel like our celebration of winners all the time doesn't necessarily celebrate the engagement that's going on.
Right. Because it is, you know, what we're implicitly celebrating, I guess, in the winners is, you know, that their process worked.
Right.
So, you know, but then it gets, you know, it gets cheapened and into only looking at the result of the winner as opposed to, you know, all the hard work that everyone put in. But, you know, this guy ended up on top.
Right.
But yeah, that's a good book title, because surely a lot of art is created out of, you know, losing in a big way.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. And a lot of philosophy and all sorts of other things. I mean, I saw your interview with Al Unser Jr., right?
Yeah.
Which is very cool. And I always liked Al. I actually raced against him at Laguna Seca in the BMW M1, and he was in a BMW M1. But like, he was 17 and I was 31, right? So he was a kid.
Right.
And I was sitting there going, this kid's fast.
Yeah.
And I was so pissed. He outqualified me, of course. But I'm right beside him on the grid. And I, for about 20 laps, I'm just trying to stay with him and looking where he's got some weaknesses and stuff. And the corkscrew, the famous corkscrew, I managed to make a pass on him in the corkscrew. Right.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh my God. And then you come down and you've got the hairpin going onto the front straight or the 90 degree.
Yep.
And I glance in my mirrors just as we're coming to that, thinking, you know, is he making a move on me? And where is he? And I look back and I'd missed my breaking point and I spun out and he went on. I never really saw him again.
Right.
But that was like my great moment, you know. And to me, that attempt, that whole thing was worth it, even though I failed in the end.
Oh, yeah.
You know, anyway, he was 17. It was probably only about his fifth or sixth race. What a natural talent he was.
Incredibly fast. All those guys with, you know, they don't have the simulator like kids do now growing up. They didn't, you know, and he just, and the big jumps, like, you know, he went from whatever, a go-kart to a full sprint car to a Can-Am car and was fast in all of them.
Right on.
Just so much talent.
Yeah, he really was.
So let's back up. I want to give the listener a little bit just of a background. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? What was kind of the scene at home? What did your parents do?
Right. So I grew up in Unionville when it was country. I walk 2 miles to school every day, you know, as they say, against the wind and uphill. But, yeah. You know, it was country then. It was country roads. And I don't know, had a pretty sort of normal life, I guess. I ended up getting sent to New Brunswick to a private school there, a cadet school, because I wasn't a very good student. Okay. And
was it misbehavior or just...
A daydreamer.
Okay.
Particularly, I was really, you know, at that time, even very engaged in poetry and art and things like that. And that really worked out well for me. Rossay was the name of the town and the school. And I ended up doing really well there. I did very well in English. I started to do well in my classes instead of so poorly. And so that was great. Went to university, dropped out after a couple of years. I'd had an art exhibition. I'd put on a folk festival. I went to Paris to study art.
Wow. And that's where you went to university.
Yeah, well, I went to Brock at first for 2 years, and then I went to Paris to study art, and I spent a year over there and came back and tried to make a living as an artist. And
like you know, oil paintings?
Painting,
or,
okay, yeah, you yeah. got it. Yeah. Exactly. And actually, some of those are on my website, et cetera. But bottom line was... What happened, I ended up with this crash. I told you about the motorcycle crash with the plate in the head and
so
everything.
Was it
else.
Like a street motorcycle?
No, it was dirt track racing, Welland County, but I wasn't running that time at Welland County. I was up in Ottawa and I was practicing.
Okay.
And
like dirt oval.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You got it. Okay. You got it. And anyway, somebody came around. It was weird. It was just a rough practice track, and you know, it had some bushes and stuff, and somebody came around the wrong way around. It was like such a strange thing. I never got to hear or understand what, because I was really a mess,
right?
But I spent a lot of time in the hospital. It gave me a chance to review what I was doing, and I thought, I'm a good artist, but I don't think I'm going to be able to make a living at this. And so got into other things and started doing other things.
So what did you do after you kind of, did you fully give up art as a professional pursuit or?
Well, and that's an interesting question. Yeah. I just had an exhibition this last weekend actually.
Okay.
And sold a couple of prints. But,
yeah.
But yes, in a way I did. I gave away a lot more than I sold thereafter.
Sure.
'Cause one of the things I found was, if I didn't get rid of them, I'd throw them out in the end because I'd end up being frustrated they weren't good enough or something like that. And so then I started giving away a lot. And it's kind of nice because every now and then I go to somebody's house and it's like, oh, wow, yeah, that's my painting up in their dining room wall or whatever. So that's kind of cool. But, yeah, I'm still doing it. And I sort of hit more... intense periods and less intense periods.
Right, yeah. Right. So what did you go and do for a living after that?
Well, I started out doing a research project in the brokerage industry, which we sold. This is like in the 70s, right?
Stocks?
Stock brokerage business. But I did this thing. It was quantitative content analysis of major Canadian newspapers and periodicals.
Okay.
Watching for trends that would anticipate government decision-making, political and economic decision-making that would impact on investments.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big switch from painting.
Very esoteric.
Yeah.
Right on. And and it did very well. And that I'd just started racing cars at that point. So what happened was I was used to living on very little money. Like when I started, I was making $18,000 a year. But over the next 5 years, my income was just going up and up and up and up. My lifestyle wasn't.
Right.
Because the money went into racing.
Of course, as it does. Yeah.
That's what you do.
Yeah.
And so.
But how did you get the racing bug? How did, like.
Because I'd been racing the bikes. And
okay.
Then I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. And then I bought a Porsche 356 from Horace Kroll. Do you remember his name? Yeah.
Yep.
Horace ran in Can-Am, was the last winner of the Can-Am, actually. And an unusual guy. He was in the Deutscher Automobile Club. I bought this car from him. He says, you should come to the Deutscher Club. I went. The meetings were hilarious. We could get into a whole sidebar on that. Klaus Bartels, who was the president, was just ridiculously politically incorrect and funny as hell. And it was just like a very odd environment. But it kind of, you know, I went, oh, okay. And then Horst said, well, you should race. And it didn't work out with what he was planning, but I ended up starting with a Porsche 914-6.
Okay.
And it was a piece of garbage, but I learned how to work on a car and fix it. And I bought a new body and put the stuff into it. And then, you know, ended up at our first race with the new one that I'd created, coming seventh at 12 Hours of Sebring in our class, which was, you know, pretty amazing just to finish, right? So I was happy.
But take me through, like, the first track day, and now all of a sudden you're at the 12 Hours of Sebring. That's quite the jump. Did someone say to you, wow, like, you know, you're fast, or you've got talent?
Well, you do the normal qualifying races and stuff, so you get your license. You had to do, I think it was three races you had to get signed off on in those days. And then, then I did a bunch of races. The car was breaking a lot, but when it was going, I thought, hey, you know what, I think I'm pretty competitive. Mm-hmm. So it was really that effort to get the new car built that got me to believe, because that year in the Canadian Sports Car Championship, I came third, and I thought, okay, and this is still a crappy car because I built it and I know how crappy it is, right? And so then I bought A.J. Foyt's ex-IROC car, that Porsche RSR. It's a beautiful car. I think one of my most favorite cars ever, if not my most favorite. And lovely balance and everything. And I won the Canadian Endurance Championship the next year in 1980 with that.
Okay.
So I was competitive. I didn't know exactly how competitive. And when I found that out was the next year, because I crashed the car. The second to last race, I destroyed it, which was really too bad. And especially
that car.
Yeah. And you know, I had made more money. So I went to Europe and I went to McLaren and, you know, ended up negotiating with them. I went to Sauber in Switzerland to buy one of the M1s because BMW had offered me some sponsorship.
Okay.
And so I ended up buying the one from McLaren, which was Niki Lauda's pro car, which was really cool.
Wow.
And
so you learned early that you needed good equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, didn't you find that out in a hurry, right?
Oh, yeah.
You really do. And that's it. I thought, if I have a decent car, I can win this. And I did. And then so that year with that one, I went to Daytona. And Hans Stuck was in an M1, and so was Dieter Quester, and then there was a team, a Red Lobster team, which actually was kind of questionable because they'd taken a lot of weight out of the car and done it according to what the class rule was, except the class rule was supposed to be the M1s were supposed to be heavier. So all of our cars were there, theirs wasn't, and then they changed the rules. Well, we couldn't take all that weight out at that point.
In time,
so
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So bottom line was, though, I qualified third after Stuck and Red Lobster, and they were impressed. And so BMW factory invited me to race Le Mans with them.
Wow.
And that was when the question came in, and they called me in. I actually turned it down at first because I thought, I'm not good enough. You know, I don't think I can do that. So I went to the shop that night to work on the car, and Rudy Bartling, who is another well-known endurance racer in Canada over the years back then, it was working on the team, and I told him, and he says, you idiot. He says, I'd cut off my arm to do that.
Yeah.
He says, that's just stupid. And he says, if you don't do that race, I'm not going to work for you anymore. So I went.
So you called them back. They'd have you.
And they still had had me. Fortunately, it was just 24 hours later, so they hadn't found somebody else. So I went. And I'm taking a long time for the story, but it was interesting. I go out in the track, and Le Mans at that time was just crazy.
Hair raising.
It really was. You know, under the Dunlop Bridge, you were doing 210 miles an hour, whatever that is, 350 kilometers per hour or something. On the Mulsanne Straight, our terminal velocity was around 370 kilometers per hour. And it's just this little narrow road. They didn't have all the runoff areas and the gravel and everything then. The first year I raced there, two guys were killed, right? I mean, it was serious, serious stuff. So I go out. And after a few laps, like I'm 10 seconds slower than Mark Surer, who's my teammate, and I'm come in and I know I got a problem, man. And my problem is I can't go through the kink flat out. I just don't have the
balls.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bottom line.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I say I got to fix this because I've only done a few laps and the team's not real happy with it. And so I go out there and I make the intellectual decision, flat out through the kink on the Mulsanne. And I use every muscle in my right leg trying to hold it down because it just seems to want to come off. And I go through and it's just that little bit skittery. And at that speed, it's just crazy. And my heart's going about 180 or 90. And then, you know, you go around, but I see the numbers at the pit and I've dropped 7 seconds.
Yeah, right? Yeah, there it was.
Yeah. And so I do that 3 more times, but I'm going, I don't think I can do this. So I come in and hand it over and I'm sitting in the back of the pit, sitting on some tires, and Hans Stuck, who I think was the greatest sports car driver in the world at that time. And I also related to him because he was the only other guy over 6 feet, you know?
Right, right.
And he says, David, how's it going? And I said, Hans, do you find the car a little skittery in the kink? And he says, oh, yeah. And I said, like, couldn't we crank a little more wing into it to stabilize it? Oh, he says, it'd slow you down too much in the straightaway. And I'm going, yeah. I said, Hans, I don't know that I can handle it. Oh, David, he says, don't worry about it. After a couple of hours, you'll be used to it. And it said something to me about life after that too, which is to get over fear, you just got to do it, man.
Yeah.
And you know, it's exactly right. There I was, 2 o'clock in the morning, driving with the lights, can't even see except there's the marker, and you say, okay, now I start turning in, even though you can't see the apex, and then you see it and you're going flat out and you're not thinking about it. So I that was an incredible experience, and I was thrilled. You know, there were 6 drivers on the team, and I ended up 5th fastest. So there was one guy, David Hobbs. I beat him by a tenth.
Okay.
Right?
Yep. Yep.
But that's all right. It was like, and my driving, somebody said to me, there was a German expression, you learn to swim with the school of fish you swim with. Right?
Yeah.
And that's what happened. My driving went up several notches at that race because I got to follow, I was actually following Hobbs in another M1 that allowed me to learn a whole lot of things and see how he was dancing the car through some of the corners and connections and stuff. And I went, oh, okay. It was just, man, a massive opening of the window. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to get into the nitty gritty a little bit on Le Mans because I was there for the first time this spring. And we took, it was for the Le Mans Classic.
Right,
and we took the 64 GT40.
Right.
And I, you know, I knew there wasn't going to be a lot of track time. I didn't know the track, so I spent a whole whack of time on the simulator to just, you know.
Try and get that figured.
First session, I can go out and I can drive the car hard. You didn't have a simulator going into that. Did you have enough practice time to get comfortable? No.
No. It was terrible. I was kind of treated like a fifth wheel in it.
Sure.
And, so I had 5 laps, and then I had an additional 6 laps, and then that was it before the race. But there is a whole other funny story. A brother of mine who took 36 hours practically traveling over through all sorts of travel delays and stuff, not getting any sleep. You stay in a chateau when you're there, right? They always rent those out to the teams. And so... we actually didn't get the chateau. We got what they called the farmer's house, about 150 yards away from the chateau, because with my other Canadian compatriots and my brother, he got in late. He stayed up drinking. It was the night before the race.
Yeah.
I didn't. We had a big room, and there were French windows and French doors. And in the middle of the night, my bed, which was near the French windows, I woke up and I was cold, and I thought, huh. And I thought, oh, the windows were open. So I went to close them, and I looked down, and there was a naked body on the ground about 15, 18 feet below. And it was my brother who'd wanted to go to the washroom at night and went out the French windows instead.
Oh, my goodness.
So I went running downstairs, and, you know, his face was all bloodied. He was at a bad angle. There was one arm that was clearly very broken, and it was just this mess. So I went running up to the main chateau, banged on all sorts of doors to find the team doctor to make sure that there wasn't spinal damage, right?
Yeah.
So I get him. Of course, you can imagine how popular I was banging on the doors the night before the 24-hour race. At any rate, so I get him. He says he's okay. We take him into the hospital and drop him off. During the race, for the first hour and a half, 2 hours that I was out, every time I went by the pits, I said, here's to you, Doug, and F you, Dieter Stoppard. Dieter Stoppard was the team manager who'd only given me that many laps.
Right.
And I came in, and I'd spent the entire 2 hours doing exactly four-minute laps. I wasn't 9/10 different on any lap. I was just like absolute clockwork.
Yep.
And the team treated me very much better from there on in.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it was like, but it was anger that was playing a part too. Do you know? And it's an interesting thing. Like if you can control your anger, you can use it effectively, but you got to sort of control it and channel it, you know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's certainly easy to get angry behind the wheel. You know, someone rubs you or, you know, something breaks and you got to start at the back and you're on a tear, right?
Yeah. You got it.
Huh.
Got
it. Wow. So how'd you guys do at Le Mans?
Oh, geez. It was a heartbreaker because we were doing very well. But the car broke 18 and a half hours in. So it was, and it's one of the things I noticed the difference now. I mean, the machinery today is so much more reliable. Yeah. And then the other thing is the course is so much safer. Whereas, you know, basically, of the 55 cars that started, it was rare that more than 20 would finish because of crashes or mechanical breakdown. And I guess we were running, I think, as high as 17th overall and second in class. But, it was nothing in the end.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you leave there feeling pretty good about your racing. You're with the factory guys. You've raced Le Mans. You did your job. Did you have aspirations to go, oh, I'm going to be a racing driver now, I'm going to make a living doing it, or no?
No.
Okay.
I'd gotten a lot better, mm-hmm. and I knew I was now good and competitive, but I knew I wasn't Hanstuck.
Right.
And that I never would be. Mm. So I actually, you know, I did another year with that car and, you know, did relatively well when we finished. We had a lot of mechanical issues with it, which was a heartbreak. And then, you know, I had a crash at Mosport from one of the things you're talking about, like a guy in turn one hitting me, on the right rear panel and putting me into the wall in the corner because, you know, you can't do that. You know, that's the easiest way to put anybody off. And
right.
And so I just sold the team and everything at that point. Bam, just the whole thing, got
done.
Rid of it. And then, oddly, Canadian Tire approached me. And the next year, I got to do Le Mans again with Jacques Villeneuve Sr. and Ludwig Heimrath Jr. and myself. And we were the first Canadian team to qualify at Le Mans.
Cool.
So that was really kind of cool.
So Canadian Tire put together an all-Canadian team to go to Le Mans.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was the leader because I was the guy who'd actually done it.
Right.
Which was kind of cool.
Given, with those two guys.
Yeah, exactly. Given they were really much more acclaimed than I was. But
right.
Yeah.
And how did that go? How'd you guys do there?
Again, we broke. We had a bad... there's a nice little CBC documentary thing that was done at the time. I couldn't find it on the internet. I have a DVD of it. I'll show it to you sometime, but it's, let's put it this way. We had to sit in the pits for almost the first hour of the race. We ended up lapping and running, as fast as, you know, and we would have been in the top 10 group of cars.
Yep.
We were really quite competitive. I was really happy because my times were very much competitive with both of them. And so that was great. And we were, you know, we went from dead last because that's where it started to, I think it was 38th. So we were making up at a hell of a rate. But again, it broke in the middle of the night. And I think it was then too. It's funny. It's on tape because I said, I think this is it. And it was kind of, I realized I was putting so much of my life into this. Mm. And also, you know, because of the danger in those days, I mean, you know, I'd had a friend who died each of the preceding 3 years, including Jill, right?
Yeah.
So you sort of, you know, you're taking a look at that. I'd just gotten married. We were thinking of having kids. You're going, you know what, maybe this is it. So I didn't really do any driving again until the Rothmans Porsche series, which I started when I was with Porsche.
Yeah. So how did, you know, how did that come about? You started one of the coolest spec series in the country, in my mind.
Yeah. Well, do you know, it's really neat. The 000 magazine that just does Porsche stuff just did an article this spring. So this is like, what, 35 years later? I don't know what it is. It's a lot of time later, 30 years. But giving me credit for creating the first single mark Porsche racing series in the world.
Right.
Which is really cool. And it was Canadian. And they did a big 30-page spread on it. And it was interesting. And you would relate to a lot of the principles of that. So the way I looked at it was, as you know, money is such a big deal. So I wanted to make it where we paid deep into the field.
Okay.
I wanted to make sure that the cars were as cheap as possible, mm-hmm. including as GM of Porsche, I gave them a 2-year warranty.
Okay. Right?
With their car.
Wow.
So that was part of it. We made all of the dealers, they had to do a minimum of $5,000 sponsorship for each car, and they had to sponsor at least 2 cars. They didn't have to do more, but that was part of this. So the whole series was structured around trying to make it as open as possible to people with talent, not necessarily people with just money.
Sure.
Right? So guys like Rick Bye could end up racing, you know, with Richard Spinard, who was sponsored by Downtown to a much bigger number, or Scotty Goodyear or whatever, and Paul Tracy and people like that. And it was really exciting. You've seen a couple of the races.
Yeah,
and
I've watched them on YouTube.
It was great, close racing, really a lot of fun. And I think that those principles, it's too bad there aren't other series that work on principles such as that, because one of the problems with the sport, as we know, is it's a rich man's sport.
Yep.
And, you know, trying to get around that, and there are some amazing talents that come out of that, but there's also, you know, at the same time, so many that aren't. And,
right.
And anyway,
yeah.
it's interesting.
So, well, how did you end up GM of Porsche?
The ability to talk.
Okay.
I still don't know how I did that. I was in the brokerage business.
Yeah.
I'd left for some arguments with my firm. I was unemployed. A friend of mine knew about the headhunter who was looking for this new general manager of Porsche. And the whole idea at the time was Volkswagen Canada was the last Volkswagen importership that owned the Porsche importership. And they'd created Porsche Cars North America, and Volkswagen, in their attempt to keep the distributorship, said, what if we set up a separate operation and a separate GM to run that and market and blah, blah.
Mm.
And Porsche said, okay, we'll give it a try.
Okay.
So I got the interview, and I don't know that I always do smart things, but I did a very smart thing. I wrote down everything I thought I really knew. Then I wrote down everything I thought I knew enough about to ask really good questions and engage in a conversation about. And then I wrote down everything I didn't think I knew anything about and would need to avoid.
Right.
And in the interview, I focused on the first, then got them engaged in the second, and then started to ask them questions about the third so that they could, because people love talking.
Oh, yeah.
So you get them talking. And anyway, in the end, I managed to persuade them here and then also over in Germany, and I had the job. But I took the Canadian market from the 13th largest market in the world to the 6th largest market in the world in the next 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very successful. We did the Porsche Advanced Driver School, which got imitated everywhere later.
Yeah.
And we did the Rothmans Porsche Racing Series, the Turbo Cup and everything. So we did things that really were marketing news. Like that whole thing with the 944, it wasn't seen as a legit Porsche until we did that series. And then all of a sudden, oh, this is something worth having. It's part of the Porsche heritage, et cetera.
So, right. So it's really a kind of a marketing deal to help you sell 944s.
Got it. 100%.
Wow. 100%. Huh. Did you, and I don't know, did you race in that series at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Rick asked me to drive in his, Rick Bye, asked me to drive in his team. I have to say, you know, we're talking about mechanical advantage. Let's say, I don't believe my car was prepared as well as...
Spinard's?
or several other people. And two, I wasn't dedicated to it in the way I was when I was doing, because otherwise I should have been setting it up or making sure it was right myself, and I didn't.
Right.
So I was running sort of fifth to 10th instead of first to fifth, right? Right. And in the end, I realized my ego couldn't handle it. It's like, because I'd been a little higher than that, it just, I wasn't enjoying it the same way. And I thought, yeah, people are sort of going, oh, so he's the great Dave Deacon, eh?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's tough. How did, going back to Le Mans, I just thought of this. How did you share a ride with Heimrath, who's, you know, 5 foot five or something?
No. So Ludwig Jr. is taller.
Oh, okay.
But Jacques Villeneuve was very short.
Right.
And you're right. It was brutal. My compromised positions in race cars were wild. And in that M1, I was like, you know, it was ridiculous how crunched up I was. My knees were completely bent. It was something I was always used to because I never fit in anything, right?
Right.
I'm 6 foot five, so it's like no car fit me.
No. I guess it's better than the alternative, getting in, you know, a car that's set up for you. I wouldn't be able to reach the pedals.
Yeah. As Jacques said, well, for me, it's a problem because they put so much foam behind my back.
Right.
You know, because there had to be some kind of compromise there.
Right.
He didn't feel that I had enough of one.
Oh, that's good. So did your, racing career kind of end with just, you know, setting off the Porsche Cup Series?
Yeah. And then sort of moving on to other things. In 93, that's when I started the music business.
Okay.
And over the next 7 years, I played every other week at the Rex Hotel in downtown Toronto. The Rex is sort of the jazz spot now.
Sure.
I say it's the house that I built in that we had a blues kind of sound and...
What corner is that on?
Okay, it's basically just in from University and Queen, about a block and a half west of University on the north side of Queen.
I think I've had lunch there.
Yeah. Okay. It was a real dive when we first went there, a real dive.
Okay.
And it got fixed up over time, but we were sort of slowly overcoming the very rough street crowd that, you know, was there. And we ended up, you know, over that time, I think basically every year for 7 years, we had the biggest grossing nights. We had a really good following. We had a good time. And over that period of time, I ended up selling almost 10,000 CDs on a privateer basis.
Wow.
So it was like quite a success in a way, but I never got signed and I never got the real exposure.
So the business was you started a band.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all jazz.
Well, it isn't really jazz.
Okay.
It's kind of blues roots.
Sure.
Like people, so who I get compared to, Robbie Robertson, Leonard Cohen, Tom Waits, Joe Cocker, the husky voice, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
A bluesy, rootsy kind of vibe to it. And so I've just started doing that again. My early focus had been more on poetry and spoken word. And there's sort of a whole long story to that, which I don't need to get into right now, but it's
bad breakup.
No, it's like walking up by a bar in New York City in the Upper East Side, and there was a sign outside that said, George Plimpton, poetry reading tonight. And I thought, hell, I write as good poetry as George could ever write. And, you know, he was the guy who wrote Paper Lion. And that's anyway. And I thought, yeah. So I went in, ordered a large scotch, asked to talk to the manager, and said, I want to open for George. And she says, give me a poem. So I did. And she said, yeah, I kind of like that. Okay, you can open for George.
Cool.
Anyway, I came back because they invited me back to be their Valentine's Day poet. And they had a folk singer who was opening for me. And she's really good. And, you know, I was singing, man, my stuff's kind of boring. I'm just spoken word now. So I should put it together a band. And a year later, I put out my first CD.
Wow.
So that's the inspiration for that.
Right. So again, did you pursue with your band? Did you, you know, try, did you quit your job and try and make a living, you know, with the band, or was it kind of something on the side?
Yeah, it was somewhere in between.
Okay.
So
I like that space.
Yeah. I had an advertising company. We'd run into trouble. There was a New York firm, very large, the Interpublic Group, a New York Stock Exchange listed company, had bought into half of my company. But we had a bad client that had a bad debt and cost $1.5 million. And bottom line was, I couldn't cover it. So they bought me out for very little money.
Right.
And I was sitting there. And the guy who was the interface between me and the Interpublic Group was a really nice guy and a race car driver, which didn't hurt. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, David, we'll give you a consulting contract for a few years at $1,000 a day.
Okay.
And here's what we want you to do and act on our behalf here, because we think you have good business sense or whatever. So it meant I could work 2 to 3, sometimes 4 days a week, make quite a lot of money,
yeah,
and spend the rest of the time doing the music. And so I was sort of half-time music, half-time consulting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So where did, that music take you to, and then you took a hiatus from it, right?
Yeah. So
I guess what was the height of it, you know?
Yeah, I ended up doing 3 CDs. It's a lot of work to run a band. It's like running a race team, you know?
Sure.
It's like you got all these different personalities, but with a band, you don't have any adults, you know? So you're trying to work with the fact that you're the only adult in the room, and you got to make every decision for everything and try and manage it through. And then, you know, people don't show, or they call you the last minute and say, oh, I can't make that gig, or I can't do this. You know, I worked it out over the period of 7 years I was going. I actually played with 46 different musicians or backup singers or whatever in total, even though, you know, it was like 5 of them who were the core group, all these changes would occur. And it's a huge commitment. And I kind of just got to the point where I said, I just don't know, I have the energy for this. Plus, I didn't have the job anymore that was paying me for doing very little.
Right.
So I had to work again.
Right.
So that's what I did. I started working again.
So what'd you do? You've got all these, you clearly have an entrepreneurial spirit. What company did you start after that?
Okay. So I started doing a little consulting, and then my brother found this company. He wanted me to do some consulting for. It was, you know, some intellectual property for hybrid electric vehicles.
Okay.
And
in the 90s?
Yeah, late 90s. It was, so 2000 was the, so Cam and I started Azure Dynamics, which was a hybrid electric vehicle company.
Wow.
We focused it on the, he was CEO and I was president and COO. And I was the car guy, so I sort of did the whole development side. We focus it on light commercial vehicles. So those Purolator trucks you see driving around the city that says hybrid electric, those are our trucks.
Wow.
Yeah. And there they are, you know, like 20 years later. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, so we did that for until 2007. And then I had a disagreement with the board and my brother as to how we should move to the next stage of commercialization. And unlike, you know, what happened with Tesla, there were huge losses at the beginning that ended up allowing them to build a big company.
Right.
But our board didn't want to take any losses. They wanted to sell these at a certain high price. And that premium was just hard to overcome. And I was saying, no, we got to take some losses for a year, maybe a year and a half, in order to get the volumes up to the point that we can do this on a commercial basis. Anyway, net result was we split ways. I started another company and got into another business.
So what was the next company?
Okay, so it was, yeah. Water treatment, basically. And that was, I ended up here in Milton at STT, which I changed to STT EnviroCore. We did water treatment in the oil sands and in mining companies, cleaning up the acidity water treatment. And then also did bolted tanks, which are sort of a better way to do tanks and welding on site and everything else. You get a higher quality, plus you can dismantle, put somewhere else later, et cetera, et cetera. So we were doing that business, and I did that for a number of years. That got sold in 2017, and then I started another company. It was actually a takeover of a company that was going bankrupt in Nova Scotia.
Okay.
The STT was in real trouble too. The bank was had it in treatment, et cetera. So that one was a turnaround. And then New Air, which was a ventilation company, was actually going bankrupt. And I bought it for $15,000 in Windsor, Nova Scotia.
Wow.
And we've turned that around. And it's now employing like 45 people and doing, you know, three times level of sales that it was doing back in 2019.
Yeah. And it's an air treatment company?
It's air ventilation. Okay. So nowadays with sealed homes, all your air source, exhaust and input is one place.
Right.
So you have either an HRV, heat recovery unit, or energy recovery unit, so that you don't just send out hot or cold air and lose the value of your air in the home.
Right.
And so that's what it's focused on, ERVs and HRVs, and yeah.
Wow. And then you just sold that company?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are you doing now?
Well, I'm still doing consulting for them.
Okay.
And then a buddy of mine has a company that's in a little bit of trouble, and so I've been helping him out a bit because I'm now have a bit of a reputation for turnarounds.
Right.
But what I'm really doing now is the music and doing a little more painting as well. But really, I've been very focused on the music. It's a lot of work, actually. We just released the first new album in March of this year. We're now at over 400,000 views on YouTube.
So wow.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
And I'm just about to release the second one. So out of the two, it's 18 songs, right?
Okay.
Which, that's a lot of work to write and record and go through the process of getting that done. So that's what I've been doing for basically the last 3.5 years is getting that work done.
Wow. So for you, the music, is it mostly on, you know, the writing, the lyrics side, or are you involved also in, you know, the entire band?
Yeah. So the difference this time is I used to always write the lyrics and sometimes come up with the melodies.
Mm.
Now I'm doing the melodies and the lyrics,
okay.
But my guitar player is who does the arrangements because I don't have any musical training and he's really very talented. And so he's been doing the arrangements. And so what I do once I've got something written is I just sing it a cappella into my telephone and send it to him. And then he says, how do you like if I put it together this way or what about that? And we go back and forth and then we go to the studio and lay it down.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. So in this day and age, I'm sure music has changed a lot. Is it a lot more focused on getting, you know, content out as opposed to finding gigs?
Yeah. Well, it's a combination.
Yeah.
So I'll put it this way. I've decided this time around it's going to be about getting content out.
Okay.
Because I don't want to schlep around making, you know, $200 a night in staying in crappy little motel rooms and everything and trying to build an audience that way.
Right.
Either I'm going to get it heard, as I'm working at doing very aggressively now, where it builds enough of an audience that we can actually get paid properly to play live, and then it'll be worth it. One of the things that's kind of sad about how music has gone today is artists have really, other than the really big ones like Taylor Swift, who can call her own tune with Spotify and others and make them pay whatever she wants in a way because
sure.
They need her more than she needs them.
Right.
But otherwise, the money is really crappy and they try and keep it that way. Spotify in particular, I shouldn't be saying that, but it's tough, man.
They don't pay me. So.
And the bottom line is that you got to get to a certain level before you'll get paid by them, you know, anything meaningful.
Right.
So there's investment up front on the marketing side, on a PR side. And that's what I'm doing. And I got a really good team who are helping me on that. And Slammin' Media is the name of that group who are handling it for me. And as I said, we're getting some great views. We're now starting to get traction on Spotify too. And I think if we can really do that, that's what's going to crack it. And now I'm starting to get a bit of American radio play, just a little bit, but I got a guy now who's going to be marketing that for us.
Cool.
And, yeah, we'll see what happens.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. That's, you know, so many different jumps, and it's funny the balance between, and you kind of hit the nail on the head with, you know, pretend you're interviewing yourself, because, you know, I work my butt off at the racing and I want to make it, you know, economically viable. I want to, you know, have enough sponsorship to pay for the whole deal. You know, you're always going to spend all the money you have, but, you know, have it paid for, and then also always have, you know, two or three different irons in the fire to try and, you know, make a living and keep your family happy.
Right on. That's exactly right. I think as well, though, and it's interesting because I'm sure this will be true of you. I think for anybody who's engaged in things like that, the fact of the matter is you're going to be subsidizing it in some way, either with the amount of hours you're putting in or the money you're adding into it. And, you know, one of the things that I have been interested in life, you know, I've had people say to me many times, oh, wow, man, that's so cool. You raced the Le Mans, you did this, you did that. Wow, that would be a dream. I'd love to do that. I say, okay, so have you ever done a driving course? You know, have you ever gone to the track and seen whether you had any talent?
No.
Well, you know, it's easy to do that.
Yeah.
You can go do it. And they're not asking. All you got to do is pay a little bit of money and somebody will put you on the track and you can do it. So what's stopping you?
Right.
Oh, well, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. That's what's stopping you.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, you got to make a commitment to it. And it's interesting. I was thinking about, there is a similarity between artists, racers, other people with passions like that. And that is, in the end, the money is not the deciding factor.
No.
It just simply isn't. And I could have made more money in my life. I could have kept more money in my life. But what I haven't done is miss living any of my life.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I, you know, so whether it's music or racing or, you know, any number of other things, I didn't miss the opportunity when the door was open to try it.
Right, right. And do you think, you know, because there's this whole school of thought, and it's not right or wrong, but, you know, the way you've lived your life, and I try to, is there's this school of thought that if, you know, you've got this passion, you have to quit everything else and go all in for this passion and make a living at it. And, you know, it might or might not work, but regardless, you're going to end up living on a couch for a bunch of years. You know, I think you might have advice to the contrary.
Yeah, one of the things I find amusing sometimes is, you know, when they're interviewing athletes and they've just won something and they say, so see, this just proves, follow your dreams, do everything, work hard, you'll get it.
Yep.
Well, no, that's not true.
Yep.
The second place thing I was talking about before, you know, there's one person who's got first place, one man or woman who's got first place. And then there are, in any given circumstance, you know, 25, 30, 40 other people who don't.
Right.
Right. And who may never, but that doesn't mean they can't get the incredible joy and engagement that is involved in being a participant and trying their best. And, you know, when Silken Laumann came third in the Olympics after she'd had her leg cut in half 6 weeks before, right? Was that bronze medal that you could see that, I mean, she won it by about 3 inches, you know, it was like, and she just gave everything for that. Was that any less accomplishment than any other medal at that Olympics? I don't think so. It was interesting, the head of the Olympics that year, actually that was the only medal ceremony he gave the medals at, because he wanted to honor her for what she'd done. So it isn't just about winning. It isn't just about money. And it's a balance of what are the things that work in your life. Is, you know, because, as we said, I mean, in racing, not everybody's going to be Lewis Hamilton, you know.
Yeah.
It's, but it doesn't mean they're not, you know, fully, I mean, watch any race and see the amount of commitment and how good and how talented and how extreme the skill level is and say, okay, well, there aren't a lot of people who are going to be able to do that. So let's get it easy. Doesn't mean you don't do it. It just means, yeah, don't throw your whole life into it. You have some sense of who you are. That's why you said, because actually Canadian Tire offered me that year a sponsorship, a big one, that would have paid me $250,000 and I turned it down. And I did because I knew I didn't have the talent to run at the level that they would really need the results at.
Right.
Right. And I think that realism needs to be part of our lives.
100%. Yeah, 100%. And what I love about, you know, your process with the music and how you're going about it and how you've done the racing too is, you know, a lot of people can be enthusiasts and never really put themselves up against the market and see, you know, the true value of the thing. Whereas I think that's so important to, you know, as just feedback for doing what you love. Like the more feedback, the better, you know, see how the market receives it.
That's right. And push it as hard as you can.
Right.
Who knows where you might get to. I mean, I think I write good music, and I think actually this next album has got some really strong commercial hooks and still meets my standard of writing in a sense. And so who knows? That may go, and it may not. But it won't have changed the intensity or the experience. It's just a different result. And, you know, I'm getting some critical acclaim. We'll see. Maybe that turns into something. But does it change why you're doing it? No, you know, you got to do it. And like you say, measure yourself. You do that when you, with the racing you're doing. And you, and it's great. Like, you're in a great series. I think the best Canadian series today is clearly that. It's, you know, but it's very highly competitive and tight racing. And as similar as you're going to get in terms of preparation of the cars, et cetera. I mean, there's always going to be differences, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I always say, like, it's, well, for sure, as a Canadian-only series, it's top level.
It's it, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then getting to, you know, getting to run Mosport twice, getting to run the Toronto Indy, Three Rivers, like, the only, you know, cherry on top would be if we went to Tremblant. That would be really cool to have a NASCAR race at Tremblant.
It would. Yeah. That's, I don't know that that track can handle it. I'm not sure. It's pretty narrow, and I think it would need some work. I mean, I haven't seen it in a few years, so maybe it's better. But, you know, most boards so changed, and it needs to be for your cars. I mean, you're banging around some big machinery there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who... was it Hans Stuck that you know, who was the most talented guy you raced against or that you got to witness kind of a talent firsthand?
Yeah, Hans.
Yeah.
At Daytona, and when we were running those M1s there. And as it turned out, I ended up hooked up just behind him as I came out on the track. And so I started following him around. And, you know, you got that infield section, and then there's a left-hander up onto the banking, right? And in that left-hander, he went through, and he went through in a nice smooth drift. And as I was coming through behind him, I noticed a little dark patch on the pavement, and it was something, some kind of fluid, which is never good. And so I got a real quick break, and it slid hard, and I had to really catch it.
Yeah.
And I realized he had to have seen it and corrected as he went through it, because you couldn't respond to it fast enough, right? And I thought it just that sort of supernatural ability, that spider sense to that this is the fraction of second I'm going to be there, and he would have done just a little correction, and you never saw a change at all in his in the shape of how his car was sliding through the corner. And I thought, yeah, that is not me,
right?
Is yeah. That was a moment that just imprinted itself as to, and if you add that up, you know, over 10 corners or something, and when you're in a race, it's not a lot, but after 10 laps, it is.
Right.
Do you know?
Yeah. So much of racing is about, you know, just not making the mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to be, you know, whatever, 5/10 faster than everyone else in one corner or one sector. But if you, you know, if you're perfect, everyone else loses.
Yeah.
You know, a tenth.
Yeah. That's right.
Huh. Yeah. Where does your, I do a lot of reading, and I read eclectically. Where does your inspiration come for, you know, your lyrics and your poetry and stuff? Is it other musicians? Is it other poetry? Is it reading books?
It's really diverse. So in the last while, some of the songs, there was a song that I put on this, the album before this, called Poetry. And, you know, it was about a woman back in 2000 who I was totally in love with. And then there was another song in that album called Hard Time. And it was the other side of the bracket to that relationship.
Sure. Right?
I had a hard time not spending time with you.
Right.
Right. That, so it was, you know, that was a specific personal engagement. Then there were other things like my daughter, I have a 10-year-old, and she comes in the room the other day, a couple of months back, and she said, Dad, I'd like you to write a song, and I'd like the chorus to be, and they all sang along.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, I love that. That's a really nice line. So I wrote it and then played it for her about a month later, and she says, wow, Dad, you really take your assignments seriously. I thought that was pretty cool. But that's going to be the feature song on the album, and I'm really pleased with it. But the inspiration came from her. And basically, it was sort of, I ended up doing a thing that was kind of a memory and nostalgic in a way about, I left behind the memories, I left behind the dreams, frozen in my thought, like stitches in the seams. Mm. And, you got this whole little thing, but, in the end, it's got a nice groove to it, and it's carrying on. So that's where that came from. It's always different things. I read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations 2 summers ago because I was in a bad frame of mind about something and needing to get some
stoicism. Yeah, yeah.
And ended up, that song was Choose Not to Feel Harmed and You Cannot Be Harmed was the chorus in that, and which is out now, actually just released, Soldiers of the Universe. So it comes from everywhere. I guess the main thing is I try and make it to what I think is intelligent writing. Bob Dylan is, to me, the extreme, the most intelligent writer of the last 100 years. A great poet, really.
Yeah.
He would mock a lot of modern music. I remember in one of his songs it says, and then again it's going to be Obladi Johnny singing Tell Your Ma, Tell Your Pa, Our Love's Gonna Grow, Ooh Wah, Ooh Wah.
Yeah.
And, there's so much stuff in music that feels about as dumb as that, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's also some great stuff. And we've had in Canada some really good writers. Robbie Robertson.
Yeah, he's...
fantastic. Neil Young.
Yeah.
Joni Mitchell, even though she hasn't lived in the country for many years. Yeah. But, really fine long-term people whose music's going to be heard for a lot of years.
Right.
And whether I get there or not, I aspire to that, just like I aspired to... do well at Le Mans.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So is Dylan your kind of greatest of all time, or do you have a top three kind of?
Yeah. How would I put it? Blues is the music I like the most, I guess. But if I were to pick what I consider the two most important artists of the 20th century, they would be Bob Dylan and Pablo Picasso.
Okay.
And the reason is because they completely changed their genre forever.
Mm.
Picasso changed how art was going to be looked at forever. And Dylan created lyricism in music as the new poetry, which, in a way, the good rap is the same thing, man.
Yep.
Good rap, good writing in rap is poetry. There's a lot of crap out there, just as there is in other pop music, but there is some very, very good stuff too.
Yeah.
And, so Dylan, and in fact, Dylan was one of the first guys doing spoken word. There's a song of his, If Dogs Run Free, Why Can't We Across the Swamp of Time?
Yeah.
My mind, here's a symphony and melodies that rhyme. It was spoken word. It was a beautiful little piece. And, the breadth of his work was genius.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Huh. So I was asking you earlier if you still follow racing, and you're saying pretty much just Formula One.
Pretty much.
What are your thoughts on the current state of affairs?
Well, a couple of things. One is, if you took Max Verstappen and Red Bull out of it, just those two, this would be one of the greatest years of Formula One racing ever.
100%.
It's unbelievably good. This last race in Singapore where, they finished all within 2.5 seconds the first, four cars. It was Wow, that's fabulous. And, you know, at the same time, there's the element of you do have to appreciate Max's dominance and his ability and, you know, what he's doing with that car. I do take what Lewis said. I don't think Sergio was ever, you know, like a Nico Rosberg or Valtteri Bottas who could compete at the same sharp end. George Russell, for example, is awesome talent and probably a future world champion, and he's on Hamilton's team. I think Lando Norris, Charles Leclerc, George Russell, all could be there with Max and splitting races with them.
Yeah.
The only sad part really is the complete dominance of the car when the others are so much more competitive. But, you know, hopefully that'll get caught up a little bit more next year. Certainly, you know, that Singapore race was as good a race as I've seen in a long time. That was
awesome.
Really awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You always, you know, it's always, as a fan, it's always, it's dominant. Like when I first started watching Formula One, I remember like, you know, will Schumacher ever lose? You know, will he ever lose again? And then now it's nostalgia for that dominance. Like it was so impressive to see, right? And I think people will look back on these Max years and go, man, they really had it going on.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, like we were saying, though, before, to me, there's another element to it. You know, Stirling Moss lost a world championship because of his gentlemanly behavior, where he supported the guy who ended up winning it, not being disqualified from a race.
Yep.
If you look at Schumacher or Prost or Senna or Verstappen, all of them have pushed people off the road, have taken what we know as other drivers are very aggressive tactics and very dangerous tactics. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton's never done that. And Hamilton, therefore, stands in my mind as something really special because he stands for quality issues that are, and in terms of his standing on so many other issues about equality in the world. I mean, he single-handedly changed the face of what Formula One looks like in terms of women and people of color or other races, et cetera. It's unbelievable, his influence in that regard. And so to me, he's a giant of a human being beyond what he's accomplishing on the track, which has been phenomenal as well. And it's not to take away from, you know, I mean, those other guys are great drivers too, but we're witnessing somebody really quite extraordinary, you know, who would to me equate to like a Jackie Robinson or something like that, who's really changing the nature of how a sport is involved and engaged.
Yeah, for sure. It's such a funny, everyone comes down on different sides of it. It comes down to aggression, and there's guys who will, you know, wreck their mother in the last corner to win a race, and then there's guys who will finish second and get the win when it comes to them. And I don't really know what kind of fosters that or how people. Growing up differently, and if it's, you know, win at all cost or take what the race is going to give you kind of mentality. Yeah, it's,
well, you watch some of it, and you know, I think Max has grown, by the by, too. I think he's way better than he was 2 years ago.
Sure.
And because I watch him now leaving room with Leclerc or Norris or somebody else, like he's actually giving some room now, which it to me, wow, that's great. Because, you know, to me, it is a question of do you wreck somebody or don't you? And you may still win the race and not wreck them and make the move, but you have to respect the other person and respect what's going on. And I guess, I don't know, for me, the quality of how you do things in life does matter. Mm-hmm. If somebody's a dink, they're a dink. Do you know? It's like, what else can you say?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I ask all my guests a piece of advice, and I think you'd be a great person, you know, to give advice to, say, you know, I'll paint a little picture here. Someone's coming out of school, or they're beginning their professional career, and they really want to follow their passion and make a living doing that. What kind of advice would you give someone like that?
Not to shirk the work. Okay. That's the most primary thing. You know, I basically had two jobs my whole life, all the time. What I was doing to make a living and what I was doing with almost every other second of my day, right? And that's how I think you can still follow your dreams without sacrificing your life financially completely. And but, you know, if you want to go partying all the time, you're not going to get that done. You know where you've been. I know I was in the garage after I finished work, and I'd be there till whatever time at night sometimes, you know, or when we were doing music, you know, we'd then be at the studio practicing and working out new stuff and writing things and always working on something more and planning and how are you going to market this and what are you going to do with that? You know how hard you work at getting sponsorship and maintaining it. It's like a complete commitment to the other side of it. And that way you don't have to perhaps give up everything. My daughter in COVID, she's an actress and a model, and my older one, and she decided to go back to university. I was reading some of her pieces, and it's going, wow, she's a really good writer. She said, what am I going to do right now in COVID? And I said, why don't you try writing? Well, she's now co-writing her fifth novel, right?
Wow.
And so you never know. And now she's got a balance between these kind of risky businesses, trying to make a living as an actress, trying to make a living as a model. And now she's got the writing she can do without disturbing those. And so she's balanced out. So it's like, just keep looking at where your opportunities are and really don't mind putting in the time, because it's a lot of work.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, that's good. I really appreciate you coming on. This was fun. Tell the audience where they can find your music, where they can, you know, maybe see you live or follow you along.
Great. Well, so I'm on all of the distribution channels, so Spotify or, you know, Apple Music or any of those others, as well as on YouTube. And just look up David Deacon, and they should come up pretty easily. And my most recent one, Soldiers of the Universe, is launching this new album. So that's the other way to look, is just ask for that one and check it out.
Good. Well, right. We'll play some of your tunes on the outro here.
All right. Thanks very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Great.
We'll do it again.
Take care.